branches. I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this
week, you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the program, we're going to read the final chapter in part two of Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. This part of the book has examined how a society based on inequality has been created through abandoning the ancient human values of reciprocity and cooperation. This week's chapter looks at how the stress produced through capitalist competition and dispossession is literally the single largest cause of ill health. Susan Rosenthal, a physician and psychotherapist, then explains how the ill health created by social inequality is capitalized upon as a profit opportunity. This will set us up for the next part of the book, in which she asks and answers why we continue to put up with it. In other words, how a societal arrangement so disadvantageous to most is kept in place. She's not the only one asking these questions. In a September 11th interview on the English language version of Al Jazeera TV, American historian Howard Zinn concluded that nothing short of rebellion in America is necessary to change course. I was unable to find a clip of the original video, but the transcript of the brief interview is circulating on the internet, and I'll begin the show by reading that to you. We're also going to hear the first part of a talk and discussion in a similar vein with Professor Robert Jensen and a group of activists in Vancouver that comes to us thanks to Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. So now to the interview with Howard Zinn by Al Jazeera TV. The first question they asked him was, where is the United States heading in terms of world power and influence? Zinn replied, America has been heading for some time and is heading right now toward less and less world power, less and less influence. Obviously, since the war in Iraq, the rest of the world has fallen away from the United States. And if American foreign policy continues in the way that it has been, that is, aggressive and violent and uncaring about the feelings and thoughts of other people, then the influence of the United States is going to decline more and more. This is an empire which is on the one hand the most powerful empire that ever existed. On the other hand, an empire that is crumbling, an empire that has no future, because the rest of the world is alienated, and simply because this empire is top-heavy with military commitments, with bases around the world, with the exhaustion of its own resources at home. This is leading to more and more discontent at home, so I think the American empire will go the way of other empires, and I think it's on its way now. Al Jazeera then asked, is there any hope the U.S. will change its approach to the rest of the world? Zinn replied, if there is any hope, the hope lies in the American people. It lies in the American people becoming resentful enough and indignant enough over what has happened to their country, over the loss of dignity in the world, over the starving of human resources in the United States, the starving of education and health, the takeover of the political mechanism by corporate power, and the result this has on the everyday lives of the American people. There are also the higher and higher food prices, the more and more insecurity, the sending of the young people to war, I think all of this may very well build up into a movement of rebellion. We have seen movements of rebellion in the past. The labor movement, the civil rights movement, the movement against the war in Vietnam. I think we may well see, if the United States keeps heading in the same direction, a new popular movement. That is the only hope for the United States. Al Jazeera asked, "How did the U.S. get to this point?" Zinn replied, "Well, we got to this point because I suppose the American people have allowed it to get to this point because there were enough Americans who were satisfied with their lives, just enough. Of course, many Americans were not. That is why half of the population doesn't vote. They're alienated. But there are just enough Americans who have been satisfied. You might say getting some of the goodies of the empire, just some of them, just enough people satisfied to support the system. So we got this way because of the ability of the system to maintain itself by satisfying just enough of the population to keep its legitimacy. And I think that era is coming to an end." Al Jazeera asked, "What should the world know about the United States?" Zinn replied, "I find many people in the rest of the world don't know that there is an opposition in the United States. Very often, people in the rest of the world think that Bush is popular. They think, oh, he was elected twice. They don't understand the corruption of the American political system, which enabled Bush to win twice. They don't understand the basic undemocratic nature of the American political system, in which all power is concentrated within two parties, which are not very far from one another, and people cannot easily tell the difference. So I think we're in a situation where we're going to need some very fundamental changes in American society if the American people are going to be finally satisfied with the kind of society we have." Al Jazeera asked, "Do you think the U.S. can recover from its current position?" Zinn replied, "Well, I am hoping for a recovery process. I mean, so far, we haven't seen it. You asked about what the people of the rest of the world don't know about the United States, and as I said, they don't know that there is an opposition. There has always been an opposition, but the opposition has always either been crushed or quieted, kept in the shadows, marginalized so their voices are not heard. People in the rest of the world hear the voices of the American leaders. They do not hear the voices of the people all over this country who do not like the American leaders, who want different policies. I think also people in the rest of the world should know that what they see in Iraq now is really a continuation of a long term of American imperial expansion in the world. I think a lot of people in the world think that this war in Iraq is an aberration. That before this, the United States was a benign power. It has never been a benign power. From the very first, from the American Revolution, from the taking over of Indian land, from the Mexican War, the Spanish-American War. It is embarrassing to say, but we have a long history in this country of violent expansion, and I think not only do most people in other countries not know this, most Americans don't know this." Al Jazeera asked, "Is there a way for this to improve?" Zinn replied, "Well, you know, whatever hope there is lies in that large number of Americans who are decent, who don't want to go to war, who don't want to kill other people. It's hard to see that hope because these Americans who feel that way have been shut out of the communication system. So their voices are not heard. They are not seen on the television screen, but they exist. I have gone through in my life a number of social movements, and I have seen how at the very beginning of these social movements, or just before these social movements developed, there didn't seem to be any hope. I lived in the U.S. South for 7 years, in the years of the civil rights movement, and it didn't seem that there was any hope, but there was hope under the surface. And when people organized, and when people began to act, when people began to work together, people began to take risks, people began to oppose the establishment, people began to commit civil disobedience. Well, then that hope became manifest. It actually turned into change. The power and influence of the United States has declined rapidly since the war in Iraq because American power, as it has been exercised in the world historically, has been exposed more to the rest of the world in this situation. and in other situations. So the U.S. influence is declining, its power is declining. However strong a military machine it is, power does not ultimately depend on a military machine, so power is declining. Ultimately, power rests on the moral legitimacy of a system, and the United States has been losing moral legitimacy. My hope is that the American people will rouse themselves and change this situation for the benefit of themselves and for the benefit of the rest of the world. Those the words of Howard Zinn, historian, author of The People's History of the United States, from an interview conducted by Al Jazeera Television on September 11th, 2008.
Fear took down the winged life, the winged life we've led. So kiss the joy as it goes by, the poet William said. Like the poet said, 'cause the old future's gone, the old future's gone. We can't get to there from here. The old future's gone, the old future's dead and gone, never to return.
You know the model. The public dreams, protests, fills the streets, and the government changes course. Why did this fail to stop the Iraq war? Is the day of mass movements over? In the shadows of doubt and the razor of reality, you are about to hear Dr. Robert Jensen, author, Texas journalism professor, and well-known commentator. His topic is The Old Future's Gone, Progressive Politics in Cascading Crises, and the Struggle for Strategy. It was delivered to a select crowd of activists in Vancouver, Canada, on August 11, 2008. If you missed it, download the speech and the question and answer period as free MP3s in the speeches section of ecoshock.org or from radioforall.net. Here is Dr. Jensen.
I want to highlight the introduction's use of the term multifaceted, which is a synonym for we're not exactly sure what he does, what he knows, or why he's here. But that's what kind of, I think, multifaceted means. I am going to read a talk, I think in part because the radio folks are here and it will keep me on track, because a lot of what I want to talk about is rather new. Let me say a bit about myself so you have some sense of where I come from. I started my career after college as a journalist, and I worked for about 10 years in the corporate commercial press in the United States. So I come to this with some experience as an observer in a very traditional sense. After that, I abandoned corporate journalism and went back to graduate school to train to become a university professor, and I spent about a decade doing the traditional kind of academic game, graduate school research, to get tenure and permanent employment, at which time I abandoned the more academic aspects of that job and really threw myself into political organizing, mostly at the local level in Austin, Texas, where I live. So I come at this with a base in journalism, in the academy, and in local left feminist organizing. And I think that kind of sums up who I am, gives you some idea of where I might be going. Also, this is very much, for me, a talk about questions around political organizing in the first world among relatively privileged people, of which I sit at the top of the pile. I am white, I am male, I'm educated with a professional job, and I live in the United States. As one of my best friends reminds me, if I'd been born good-looking, I would have had it all. So I think through these questions in terms of organizing in communities where I live, which at this point is Austin, Texas, in the most privileged part of the world. And this is these are reflections about working in that context. There are, of course, other contexts in which people work politically. Before I start reading, I thought I was reflecting on one moment where I think a lot of these issues can be crystallized. I don't know where you all were on February 15th, 2003, But that was the Worldwide Day of Action during the run-up to the Iraq War. And I was in Austin, Texas, where I had been part of anti-war, anti-empire organizing for a number of years and had been involved in a number of demonstrations. We always have them in front of the state capitol. And I was very good at being the MC for demonstrations with 28 people, which was about the crowd we would usually draw, right, when we were doing work on the Iraq embargo or Kosovo or whatever it was. And so it was really striking on February 15th, 2003, because I showed up there and was going to MC that, and I looked out at more people than I knew would have ever shown up for a demonstration in Austin, Texas. We estimated there were about 10,000 people. Folks in Austin said it was the largest political gathering since the Vietnam War days. I still remember the speaker system we had only reached about halfway back. I mean, half the audience didn't even hear what we were saying from the stage. They seemed quite pleased with that, quite frankly, but the way political speeches tend to go, that's not surprising. But that was 10,000 people. Worldwide, the estimates are somewhere from 10 to 15 million people came out on that day. It was the largest coordinated day of political activity in the history of the world, and it had exactly zero effect on the course of politics. And I think I want to start there just to let that settle in. Using the internet, using sophisticated communication technology, using networks that had been developed through other issues, we were able to put into the street 10 to 15 million people, hundreds of thousands of people in major cities in the United States, even 10,000 people in a little town like Austin, Texas, and it had exactly zero effect. So what does that tell us about the state of politics that we are coping with? I'm not going to provide necessarily a direct answer to that, but I think that's always in the background for me. That's a very important moment. It was an exciting moment. I was, you know, sort of up the whole day. And at the same time, I was depressed the whole day because somewhere in the back of my mind, I knew it wasn't going to make a difference. And I think that's the nature of the struggle we're in. So this talk is titled The Old Future's Gone, Progressive Politics and the Search for Strategy Amid Cascading Crises. You see already I have a preference for alliteration. I used to write headlines for a living, so this is an occupational disease. The title, The Old Future is Gone, is something I've been thinking about ever since I first heard a song in 2003 by a singer-songwriter in the United States named John Gorka. And the title, the song is called Old Future, and the lyric is, "The old future's gone. We can't get to there from here." And that always stuck with me, the old future. And I think that insight is worth some reflection. And what I want to argue tonight is the way in which we humans have long imagined the future has to be rethought as the scope and the depth of these cascading crises we face become painfully clearer. In other words, what I'm going to argue is we're in trouble. We're in trouble on all fronts, and the trouble is wider and deeper than most of us have ever been willing to acknowledge. We should struggle to find a road that might take us through those troubles, if such a road is possible. But I doubt it's going to look like any path we had previously envisioned, nor is it likely to lead to where most of us thought we were going. So whatever one's conception of the future, I'm suggesting that we should reevaluate the assumptions on which those conceptions have been based. This is a moment, I think, in which we have to abandon any political certainties to which we may want to cling. Given human beings' failure to predict the place we are today, I don't really think that's such a radical statement. The fact is we stand on the edge of the ability of the ecosystem in which we live to sustain human life as we know it. And what kind of hubris would it take to make claims that we can know the future? Well, it takes the hubris of someone like biologist Richard Dawkins, author of the popular book, The God Delusion. This is a quote from an earlier work of his in which he wrote, quote, "Our brains are big enough to see into the future and plot long-term consequences." Well, I would argue such a statement is an indication that human egos tend to be considerably bigger than human brains, and it's a reminder of the need for humility. I first heard that statement of Dawkins in a talk by Wes Jackson, who is probably my favorite scientist and, in a sense, philosopher these days. If you take nothing else away from this talk, take away the name Wes Jackson and the Land Institute, which is a research facility he co-founded doing work on sustainable agriculture. And Jackson is a scientist. He's a plant geneticist by training. But he's also, I think, an important philosopher. And one of the things he's been developing is, in a sense, a very obvious and important truth that we ignore too often, which is that for all of our cleverness, human beings are far more ignorant than we are knowledgeable. That is, we're kind of easily seduced by the accomplishments of human beings, you know, skyscrapers, the internet. We can map the human genome. And it leads us to this illusion that we have control over a world that is far more complex than we have the ability to really understand. So Jackson suggests we would be wise to recognize this fundamental state and commit to what he calls an ignorance-based worldview that would anchor us in the intellectual humility that is going to be needed if we're going to survive the more toxic effects of our own cleverness. So in a political context, let's think about, you know, these clever claims that have been made about the future. Is there anyone in the room who wants to accept the neoliberal claim that the triumph of corporate capitalism in electoral democracies is the so-called end of history, and that all that's left is to tinker with these systems to produce the good society? That was a claim made about the future. I don't know if there's anyone in the room who would want to defend the notion of so-called scientific socialism that would not only explain all of recent history, but plot out the glorious future before us. And I seriously doubt there's anyone who here wants to defend the notion that the return of the Messiah is going to give us all a first-class ticket to the New Jerusalem, at least those who believe. To reject those, what I would call very desperate attempts to secure the future, is not to suggest that there's no value in any of those schools of thought, nor is it to argue that there's nothing we can know and that we shouldn't use our knowledge to guide action. Instead, what I'm suggesting is that we recognize the limits of human intelligence, and I'm arguing that would be realistic. And by realistic, I mean that we avoid the instinct to make plans based on the world we wish existed and deal with the world as it does exist. And from there, I would want to go forward and argue that being realistic means being radical. Now, so what do I mean by sort of being realistically radical? Well, imagine you're on a train, and you're riding quite comfortably in perhaps the club car of the train, and you look up ahead and you see that the tracks suddenly end quite abruptly, and you recognize that if the train continues at its pace, it will derail if you continue to move forward. So you suggest that the train stop, that the passengers disembark, that you evaluate the situation and perhaps consider going forward on foot. Now, that would require a major shift in the way people are traveling and living, but it does seem to be the only realistic option at that point, because to go forward would be to court disaster. So if you propose this course of action, but others who had also grown quite comfortable riding on the train said to you, well, we like the train, and so arguing that we should get off isn't realistic. What would you say to that claim that you aren't being realistic? Well, I think at least in the United States, I won't speak for Canada, but in the contemporary U.S., we're trapped in a very similar delusion. We're told that it is realistic to capitulate to what I would consider a thoroughly absurd idea that the systems we live in are the only systems possible because some people seem to like them and wish that they would continue. So what if real democracy is not possible in a nation of 300 million people? Well, that's too bad, because the only realistic options are those that take that way of organizing a polity as immutable. What if our current level of first world consumption is exhausting the ecological basis of life? Well, it's too bad. The only realistic options are one that take that lifestyle as non-negotiable. What if the hierarchies on which our lives are based are producing extreme material deprivation in much of the world and a kind of dull misery among many of the privileged? Well, too bad, because the only realistic options are those that take hierarchy in human societies as inevitable. So I want to offer a different view of reality, with two claims. Number one, we live in a system that, taken as a whole, is unsustainable, not only over the long haul, but now also in the near term. And number two, unsustainable systems can't be sustained. Now, that's my profound theoretical insight. You might want to write that down. That's a very important one. That's my own theory. Unsustainable systems can't be sustained. Now, okay, that's hard to argue with. The real question, of course, is whether or not we do live in a system that is, in fact, unsustainable. And I don't think there's any way to prove that definitively, but I think we can just take a minute and ask ourselves, look around, for instance, in the Simon Fraser University Harbor Center building, and ask if you can imagine a world like this going forward into the indefinite future, or even for more than a few decades. If we take a minute to consider the end of the era of cheap fossil energy, the lack of any viable large-scale replacements for that energy, and the ecological consequences of burning what remains of it, if we ponder the indicators of the health of the planet, things like groundwater contamination, topsoil loss, the level of toxicity that's all around us, and if you factor into those realities the widening inequality in the world, the intensity of the violence in the world, and the desperation that so many people feel at every level, think about all of that for a moment. Right? And based on whatever you know personally about those issues, do you think that is a sustainable system? When we take a moment to let all of that kind of wash over us, does it feel like a sustainable system? If we can sort of let go of our attachments to the world, can you imagine that is a sustainable system? Right? In other words, all of the ways we perceive the world, it seems to me, tell us, in fact, that there is nothing sustainable about this world. So to be honestly realistic in the face of all of this is to recognize the failure of basic systems and to abandon the notion that all we have to do is recalibrate or reconfigure these institutions. So this is what I mean by the old future, the way we thought about the future, the way we thought things might work out. It is gone. That old future, I think John Gorka was right, is gone. The nation state and capitalism are the core of that system, and they have given rise to a high energy mass consumption world in privileged societies that have left us saddled with what an interesting author, James Howard Kunstler, not someone I agree with on all counts, but I think he has appropriately called that a living arrangement with no future. The future that we have been dreaming about is truly based on a dream. It is not based on reality. And that is why I think we have to get realistic, which means getting radical. Now, I'm going to suggest one way to think about this present that we're dealing with and help us with the future is to go back and think about the past. We use history to arrange the way we understand complexity. Hopefully it will be useful to us today. And one of the ways I've been thinking about history is to think of what I would call the three most important revolutions in human history: the agricultural revolution, the industrial revolution, and the delusional revolution. The agricultural revolution dates back about 10,000 years ago when human beings, a gathering hunting species, first figured out how to cultivate plants for food. And there were two crucial things that result from that. One is ecological, the other is political. Ecologically, the invention of agriculture kicked off an intensive human assault on natural systems. By that, I don't mean that gathering hunting people never did damage to a particular ecosystem, but the large-scale destruction we cope with today has its roots in agriculture, in the way that human beings have systematically exhausted the energy-rich carbon of the soil. And this is what Jackson would call the first step in the entrenchment of a fundamentally extractive economy, an unsustainable economy. So human agricultural practices have varied from place to place, but in general, human agricultural practices have never been sustainable, nor have the other extractive economies that arose from them. Meanwhile, politically, the ability to stockpile food made possible concentrations of power and hierarchy that were relatively unknown in gathering hunting societies. And again, it's not to say that prior to the agriculture that humans were not capable of doing bad things to each other, but the large-scale institutionalized oppression, as we understand it, really does have its roots in this agricultural revolution. Now, the Industrial Revolution, which comes in the last half of the 18th century in Britain, intensified the magnitude of that human assault on ecosystems and human beings' assaults on each other. It unleashed the concentrated energy of coal, oil, natural gas. It created a machine-based world, which has admittedly produced unparalleled material comfort for some. And whatever one thinks of the effects of that material comfort, and I think at best it's a kind of mixed story, the processes that produce that comfort are literally destroying the capacity of the ecosystem to sustain human life as we know it into the future. And in the present, those comforts produced by that are clearly not distributed in a fashion that is consistent with any meaningful conception of justice in any system, theological or secular philosophical system. So what this means is these first two revolutions have left us in a place where we live in a way that's in direct conflict with common sense and our own stated principles. So the question is, how did we get to this place? And I think the answer has something to do with what I want to call the delusional revolution, which is a term I use for the development of very sophisticated propaganda techniques in the 20th century, especially a very highly emotive and image-based advertising system that have produced in the bulk of the population, especially first world societies, a distinctly delusional state of being. And even those of us who try to resist it often can't help but be drawn into the delusion in certain ways. And as a culture, we end up collectively acting as if unsustainable systems can be sustained, simply because we want them to be. If you think about it, much of the storytelling in this culture, and storytelling is how we come to understand the world in so many ways, particularly the dominant storytelling institutions, which are the mass media, they all remain committed to maintaining this delusional state, and it becomes very hard to extract oneself from the story. So, in summary, looking at history, what I want to suggest is the agricultural revolution set us up on a road to destruction. The industrial revolution ramped up the speed as we careened toward that end. And the delusional revolution has prevented us from coming to terms with the reality of where we are and where we're heading. So that's the bad news. The worst news is that in the society I live in, the United States, there is considerable resistance to even discussing, to even putting these questions on the table. And in a sense, that's not surprising, because I go back to Wes Jackson, who has suggested that part of the problem is we are a species living, as he calls it, out of context. I think that's an important thought. Jackson always likes to remind audiences that human beings like us, the modern human with the big brain, we've been on the planet about 200,000 years. Right? And that means these revolutions, going back 10,000 years, are only 5% of human history. So we're living in systems that we did not evolve in over the long term and which we really haven't figured out how to adapt to in the short term. So realistically, again, we need to get on a new road if there is going to be a future. The old future, that road we imagined that we could travel, is gone. I think it's part of the delusion. So unless one accepts what I would describe as an irrational technological fundamentalism meaning this idea that we will always be able to find high energy, high technology fixes to whatever problems we have. The fact is, and there are no easy solutions to these ecological and human problems. The solutions, if there are to be any, will come, I think, only through a significant shift in how we live and a dramatic downscaling of the level at which we live. And I say if because I don't think there's any guarantee there are, in fact, solutions. History does not owe us a chance to correct our mistakes simply because we would like one. So, where does this leave us? I think this leaves us, or at least it leaves me, arguing for a joyful embrace of the truly awful place we find ourselves, right? Which may seem a little counterintuitive, actually. It may seem a little psychotic, because why would one invoke joy in response to a recognition of these very awful circumstances? But I think, for me, it's just a recognition, again, of reality, of who I am and where I sit in the world. I'm part of that species living out of context, and I'm saddled with the mistakes of our history, not to mention no small number of my own mistakes. But I am still alive in the world. I think one can go forward with a kind of intellectual humility with an awareness that you could be wrong at any given moment. In fact, the chances are you probably are wrong at any given moment, and still move forward based on some set of principles. I think I'm simply suggesting it's still a good thing to be alive, and that to be fully alive means to struggle, and to struggle joyfully. It doesn't mean one has to ignore the reality. I wake up every morning, borrowing a phrase from a friend of mine, Jim Coplin, from whom I've learned quite a bit. Jim told me one day, this was right after 9/11, and he said, in the United States at least, everybody's talking about how everything had changed after 9/11. And my friend Jim said, nothing has changed for me. He said, before 9/11, I woke up every morning in a profound state of grief. And after 9/11, I wake up every morning in a profound state of grief. He said, nothing has changed. And I think that's true. But it's also still true that we live in a kind of creation that is joyful, that the mystery of it still produces that kind of joy, at least for me. So I suppose if thinking of maybe the sort of pop culture, the bumper sticker version of this is, life sucks, it's great to be alive. You can accept the apparent contradiction of that. All right, so in the title of this talk, and in references, I've been talking about crises, these multiple crises, and I have yet to really name them. And in part, I didn't start by naming them because I suspect as I've been talking, you've been sort of running through your own catalog of crises, how you understand the problems of the world. For me, I would organize them as perhaps a political crisis. The recognition that meaningful democracy, that is, a conception of democracy in which ordinary people have a role in the formation of public policy, is probably impossible in large-scale political units like the modern nation state. There is an economic crisis, the brutal inequalities that exist now within, internal to every corporate capitalist economy, and between countries in a world that is dominated by that very predatory capitalism. And, of course, an ecological crisis, the fundamentally unsustainable nature of the systems and lifestyles that arise from those systems. But I want to suggest there's also another level of crisis, which I suppose we could call cultural or philosophical, and one that is perhaps not as tangible, but has a lot to do with the way, at least I understand, where we sit in the world today. And for me, that crisis is best identified by talking about the work I do on the feminist critique of pornography, which we'll talk about more tomorrow night. For about 20 years, I've been studying and involved in organizing around the pornography industry, which is shaped by patriarchy, white supremacy, and that very same predatory corporate capitalism. And the reason I think it's an important issue in part is I think it provides a kind of mirror onto the collective consciousness of the culture. So we live in a world in which large numbers of people, mostly men, derive intense sexual pleasure from images of cruelty and degradation toward women, often in an extremely racist context. A smaller number of people, again, mostly men, profit from this, and except for a few people on the margins, mostly rooted in feminism and other radical philosophy, there is no significant progressive critique of it in contemporary society. What I think pornography tells us is what the world looks like when there is no more empathy. Right? What a world looks like bereft of the fundamental values of compassion and solidarity, where there is no sense of shared humanity. I think many aspects of this world, I think of the world these days as being mass-mediated, mass-marketed, and mass-medicated. And it is a world that can slowly strip us of basic humanity in ways that I think make it very difficult to respond to these other crises. And that's one of the things I worry about. So trying to bring this into focus and adding up these crises, based on my political activism, especially over the last decade, and my general sense of the state of the world, I now want to make just a few thoughts about political organizing, about strategy. Again, I make these with a fair amount of humility and no, you know, definitive statement, but I think they are things to think about. First of all, I think it's, again, reflecting on the conditions in the United States, it's almost certain that there will be no significant political change in the next year or two in the United States. The culture is simply not ready to face this kind of question. And that might suggest that it is not a time to go forward in the world proposing all-encompassing solutions, but in fact a time to kind of drop back and sharpen our own analysis and to try to engage in as much conversation as possible about these kinds of crises, which goes against the grain for activists, because activists like to act. You want to move in the world toward action. But there is also, I think, a need, and especially at this time and place, to try and deepen our analysis. The second claim I would make is that it's probable that there are no mass movements likely to emerge in the next decade in the United States that will force leaders or institutions to face these questions. A lot of people in the United States think that until conditions in the privileged societies get dramatically worse, people are going to be almost paralyzed, stuck in the inertia that comes from that privilege. That suggests that, to use the terminology of the old left, this is a time for cadre building, a time not to pretend mass movements are likely to emerge, but to bring people together who can be the core of such movements when political conditions do change, and I think they will. I think it's also plausible to suggest that the systems in place cannot be changed peacefully, and that the forces that have been set in motion through patriarchy, white supremacy, nationalism, capitalism, cannot be reversed without serious ruptures in the way we live. That would suggest to me that when we plan political strategies for perhaps the best case scenario, we should not forget to prepare ourselves for something much worse. And finally, to be more upbeat, I see some people looking a little dour out here. So to be a little more upbeat, my final thought is that it's worth considering the possibility that our species, the humans with the big brains, are in fact nothing more than an evolutionary dead end, right? Which I say actually not to add to the depressing moment, but to realize that that is within the realm of the possible. And it doesn't mean that you stop working. It just means you recognize the world we're in. So I am going to end upbeat, of course. Every talk has to end with hope. So, and I kind of want to end by celebrating human beings, which may sound a little odd given the kind of relentlessly grim nature so far. But I do think there's a way to kind of put a perspective on this that is actually, for me, rather heartening. And I'll go back to Wes Jackson, who never shies away from naming the nature of these problems. He's a very blunt fellow. But he also always reminds us that we should probably go easy on ourselves, because he suggests we're trying to do something that no species has ever had to do, which is to self-consciously limit ourselves in this quest to extract the energy-rich carbon from the world. And that is no small task, to self-consciously impose limits on an entire species. And if one recognizes the task at that level, then it's almost certain we are bound to fail. But we have to take those failures in, I think, that context. And I think they're easier to accept and therefore easier to potentially overcome if we recognize three things. Number one, we are animals, right? That we have these considerable rational capacities, but we are still animals driven by forces that are never fully rational and cannot be completely understood by anyone. Second, we are tribal animals. That is, whatever political units we live in today, our evolutionary history is essentially tribal. And we were designed in evolutionary terms to live in small groups. Some would say groups of probably no more than 150 people. Finally, we are tribal animals living in a global world, that the past 10,000 years of human history, and especially the past 500 years of imperialism and colonialism, have left us dealing with these human problems on a global scale. We can't avoid that. So even if our future is a return to life at a much more local level, as many people think it will be, and I would tend to agree, at the moment, we also have a moral obligation, especially those of us living in more privileged sectors, to deal with the realities of that past 500 years in which considerable wealth has been extracted from one portion of the world to enrich another. It's especially the portion of the world I live in. So what does all this mean in practice? In practice, I think what it means is that we essentially have to adopt a two-track strategy. And in some ways, there's nothing new in this. The first strategy has to deal with committing some of our energy to rectifying the crimes of the past 500 years, especially those of us who do live with the privilege that comes in societies like the United States. So I look at myself, I'm a middle-class white American male with considerable privilege, and there's plenty of places to go to work. Movements that are trying to end patriarchy, white supremacy, economic domination, U.S. wars of aggression around the world. There's no shortage of places to put one's energy in that track. But I also think that, as many have argued for quite a long time, there's also important work to be done in experiments to prepare what we will need for this new future that we can't really describe yet. That is, whatever the limits of our predictive capacity to understand the future, I think we can be pretty sure that we are going to need new ways of organizing ourselves, or ways of organizing ourselves that harken back to some old wisdom. And that's going to be necessary because we're going to live, among other things, in a world with far less energy and far fewer material goods. So that means we're going to need technical skills that, to a large degree in the first world, have atrophied. And I mean very literally skills such as gardening, food preparation and storage, and just the ability to tinker. Right? There's been an incredible atrophying of those abilities in a very short amount of time, actually in my lifetime. But I also think we're going to need not only skills, but stories, a sense of community, a sense of what it means to be human that has been largely destroyed in this very predatory system we live in. The stories we tell in this culture today are mostly about what it means to be a consumption machine. That's the story of capitalism. And we're going to have to find ways to tell different stories about ourselves, about our sense of self, about our connection to other people, and about our connection to the non-human world, because the stories we tell matter. So in addition to the political organizing that we might be most familiar with, movements aimed at fundamental conditions of injustice, I think we also have to think about what are the skills and stories we're going to need, and how are we going to build those capacities? So in my own life, just to be very concrete, I continue to put some energy into those traditional movements. But I also have started to shift a lot of my energy to attempt to build local networks, because I think these experiments are always going to be local. So in Austin, we're starting to work on some worker-owned cooperative businesses that will be the nucleus of a social center that will bring, we hope, bring people together across boundaries and in different kinds of ways. And it isn't that there is an approved list of projects that we can hand out to everybody. These are the things you should be doing. People have different talents and temperaments. People are going to be drawn to different kinds of activities. I think all I'm suggesting is that we think about both of those levels of action and go wherever our hearts and minds might take us. So, you know, I started this talk with a warning about arrogance, so I'm not about to pretend that I have, you know, the answer to what people should do. But I do think it is abundantly clear that whatever it is, it's going to take a considerable amount of work. So I'll conclude where I started, which is with this lovely song called Old Future by John Gorka. And in that song, he tells us, "The old future's dead and gone, never to return. There's a new way through the hills ahead. This one will have to earn." And I think there's something really profound in that, the idea that there is a way through, at least the possibility of a way through. But in a world where many of us have gotten very used to living very comfortably without working very hard at all, those of us who do come from this most privileged sector, that whatever the truth of how we are going to make our way forward, it's going to take a whole lot of work, and probably more work than we've ever had to do before. So that's some ideas, admittedly rather vague, sometimes not perhaps terribly clear, but at least I think the basis for a discussion about how folks are thinking about the problems and constructing their own solutions. So with that, floor is open. Thank you.
That was Dr. Robert Jensen from the School of Journalism at the University of Texas, Austin. His talk was The Old Future's Gone, Progressive Politics in Cascading Crises, and the Struggle for Strategy.
Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. If you can't wait for the next installment, the audience discussion can be downloaded at ecoshock.org, along with a host of other essential listening. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. In last week's reading of Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal, we learned how capitalism has changed the family from an extended system supporting an independent livelihood to the nuclear family, which produces workers and consumers for the corporate system, but receives little to no social support from that system. Next, the final chapter in Part 2 of Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal.
Alex was a member of my record label, teenager though he is. He joined every vile records in the indie music biz. His parents didn't like such turns of events, so they called up a couple of thugs, send him back to Utah, lock him up, and pump him full of drugs. They say he's got problems with authority. Yeah, this is what they claim. And their psychiatric analysis has even got a name. Oppositional defiance disorder. I think I got it too. Oppositional defiance disorder. He's sick and so are you. If you think George Bush is a moron and Tony Blair's a liar, if you fantasize about setting your local Walmart on fire, if you don't like Tom Brokaw and you think he's full of it, if you feel a Rush Limbaugh punching bag might be kind of fun to hit, if bombing other countries makes you feel appalled, you have got a problem and this is what it's called. Oppositional defiance disorder. I think I got it too. Oppositional defiance disorder. He's sick and so are you. If you think school is boring and your teacher is a fool, if you don't like your congressman, you call him a corporate tool, if you were not standing to sing Save the Queen, if you turned down hamburgers and ate rice and beans, we've got a diagnosis, no matter whether you agree. Just do what the doctor tells you. Thank God for psychiatry. Oppositional defiance disorder. I think I got it too. Oppositional defiance disorder. He's sick and so are you.
Chapter 8, Profit from Pain. I'm standing on the shore of a swiftly flowing river. I hear a scream for help. I dive into the water and pull a woman to shore. As I revive her, I hear another cry. I jump back in the river to save a child. There is another call. Again I rescue. I'm so busy pulling people out of the water that I don't look upstream to see who's pushing them in. This anecdote describes the predicament of medical workers, social workers, counselors, and therapists who service the human machinery for capitalism. We're too busy rescuing people to question why so many are in distress. It is simply assumed that they must have done something wrong. They were too close to shore. They were careless. They never learned to swim. They forgot their life jackets, and so on. An exclusive focus on personal failings ignores the many ways that society makes people sick. This chapter explains how capitalism manufactures disease and how the medical system is structured, not to eliminate that disease, but to contain it politically and to make a profit in the process. Blood money. Go reckon our dead by the forges red and the factories where we spin. If blood be the price of your cursed wealth, good God, we have paid it in. The assault on health begins at work. As the ruling class extracts surplus from the working class, it leaves sickness and death behind. To maximize profits, employers compel workers to use cheaper toxic materials instead of safer, more expensive ones. To raise productivity, managers demand the maximum output per hour, despite the fact that injury rates rise with the intensity of the work. Add shift work, overtime, and the stress of personal problems, and you have a recipe for disaster. An estimated 6 million American workers were injured on the job in 1997. Almost 4 million workplace injuries were serious enough to be treated in hospital emergency rooms. In 2002, nearly 300,000 new cases of occupational illness were reported. However, the Bureau of Labor Statistics admits that this number greatly underestimates the actual amount of sickness caused by work. One medical study estimated that more than 55,000 Americans die every year from occupational illness and injury, more than die in motor vehicle accidents. The drive for profit makes work dangerous, despite efforts to promote workplace safety. Industrial laundry workers in Massachusetts were instructed never to put their hands in the machines. Signs in three languages were posted to emphasize this warning. When material got stuck, workers were instructed to shut down the machine and call the maintenance department. At the same time, every worker had a daily production quota, and those who failed to meet it could be fired. Because management had downsized the maintenance department, a worker reporting a jammed machine could wait from 20 minutes to 2 hours for it to be fixed. Lost production during that time was counted against the worker. The written rule was, don't put your hand in the machine. The real rule was, if you want to keep your job, you must clear the machine yourself. The resulting injuries were predictable. Between 1993 and 2003, the number of workers who died on the job every year ranged between 5,534 and 6,632, more than twice as many as died on 9/11. Despite this shocking level of industrial slaughter, politicians do not denounce employers as terrorists. Homeland Security does not include the workplace. 90% of all work sites in the U.S., covering 40% of the country's total workforce, are not inspected regularly for health and safety violations. When violations are found, the penalties are too small to force a change in work practices.